Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, your weekly dose of inspiration and exploration. Join me, your host, Sam Harris, as I discover how mindset can help you do incredible things through my conversations with the world's most interesting people, from tech billionaires to leading scientists, best-selling authors to notorious hackers. The goal is to increase our collective wisdom and attitudes to make us all happier and healthier, wiser and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? On the podcast today, we have Colin Billings. He is the founder and CEO of Oro, the smart lighting company, aiming to just make your home and life a much better place and thing to be in. It's really cool. And he also was one of the very first employees, like number three, at Stitcher, the podcasting platform, which basically rather changed the world of podcasting and was the first big company into podcasting besides Apple. So yeah, he's got a lot of insights into Silicon Valley, podcasting, and just living a happier life with better sleep and automation of things. So he's really cool, and I'm really happy that we had this conversation, and I hope you enjoy it.
So you've been practicing like your 60-second pitch?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been practicing it for 3 years, so it gets better and better every time.
Nice. So you ready to give the almost perfect pitch now?
Sure. So Oro is a seamless replacement for any light switch. The Oro switch itself is more like a smartphone than it is a light switch. And the first thing that happens is that we totally take thinking about your lights out of your life. But after your lights are taken care of, Oro can do all kinds of other things inside your home, including intercom, connect to Alexa. Really, all the things that you do with your smartphone are possible with Oro. So Oro is the future of the smart home without the smartphone.
Nice. So that idea that you can kind of be digitally connected and super savvy, but without being stuck to your smartphone. And
yeah, I mean, I think with any startup, you start building something and then you realize along the way that you're maybe building something slightly different. And, you know, we started out at Oro really focused on how light affects our lives at home. It's sort of incredibly important, you know, one, just to be able to do things every day in your life, but it also helps you sort of psychologically get to a state where you want to be at different moments in the day, and it affects your biology based on how you expose yourself to light across the day. But in order to sort of take lights off your plate, to automate lights, what we needed to do with that was really to take a lot of the ingredients from a hardware perspective and put them inside the Oro switch, right? So the Oro switch is very different than any other connected switch that you may have looked at, which is it's smart in and of itself. It can observe and understand what's happening around it. It can make decisions all on its own. It learns from your own activity how you like light. And that means that it's actually a tiny computer that has sensors and an interface and connectivity all connected into it. And what we realized is that we're part of this transition of sort of personal computing, if you will, inside the home. And the last time that that happened really in our lives is when we went from the mobile phone to the smartphone. And that was something that unlocked a lot of different opportunities for us outside of our house. But as we come to the door of our home, the sort of smartphone, it's sort of failing as the computing, you know, interface, if you will, for all the things that we want to do inside of our house, right? And some reasons for that are, you know, you've got to charge your phone. Another reason is there's things connected to your phone, like your email, that maybe you want to get away from a little bit when you're at your house. And it's really not always with you inside your home. And so you look at something like a smart speaker, you know, Alexa, Google Home, and they've had sort of amazing success. In America, they're going to be in, you know, roughly half the homes by the end of this year. And you have to ask yourself the sort of the question of why is that so popular? I mean, we've had speakers for a long time. It's really sort of adding something, a layer on top of a speaker that has sort of led to this. And the things that you can do with something like Alexa are actually things that you can do on your phone, right? You can go find your phone. You can open up the timer app. You can set a timer for 2 minutes. It's just infinitely easier when that sort of opportunity is ambiently distributed across your home. Wherever you are, you can say, Alexa, set the timer, or Google Home, play some music. And that sort of layer is something that gives us the connection to, one, the smart things in our home, but two, all the other services, be them sort of entertainment and music or information that we want, sort of broken away from having to find our phone. And so what Oro is sort of all the pieces that you need for any room to sort of make that possible in a form factor that seamlessly fits into every room, right? Every room has a light switch. Behind every light switch is a power source. A light switch is actually at the perfect place to sort of talk to, both from a physics perspective as well as interact with. We touch light switches more than 50 times a day already. And so Oro, in many ways, is sort of reimagining what's possible from that location in rooms. And, you know, in order to do that, the first and foremost thing that we have to do is the job of a light switch extremely well. And we do that today by essentially automating that for you. So you just walk around your house and your lights are set perfectly for the time of day or activity without you ever having to think about it.
Okay. So, but I can still change it whatever I want. So if I'm having dinner and I want to change the environment, I can just be like, oh, actually, this is a type of dinner where I want it really bright. Whereas on a normal evening, I might want it darker or something.
That's right. It's a light switch, right? It's still physically in your room. You've probably seen it online.
Yeah.
You know, it lights up. It has a touchscreen interface on the front that tells you sort of how bright the room is and what the level of the light is at. And you can just interact with it like a normal light switch, right? You know, we've seen 5-year-olds and 75-year-olds easily know how to use the Oro switch without sort of any learning. And so you can always override that. But what Oro is doing is sort of taking memories of every moment, right? It's sensing, you know, what's happening around it, how bright the room is, and sort of learning what your preferences are so that with just a few days, you know, Oro is already sort of stepping in and giving you that light that you would have otherwise set for yourself as soon as you walk into the room. And, you know, you do whatever it is you're doing at that point in the time in the day, and then you just check out, you leave, and Oro will make sure the lights are off after you're gone.
Yeah, that's cool. So how did you initially come up with the idea? Were you just like, oh, there needs to be more automated light switches in my life right now? What's going on?
So for me, I wasn't sleeping very well in 2014. I just was struggling with sleep and really trying all kinds of hacky things to get better sleep at night, everything from melatonin pills to blackout shades, white noise machines, really the whole thing. Anything you can sort of go to Amazon and type sleep aids in, I'd probably ordered it. And out of chance, a friend of mine recommended an app for my computer called Flux. Have you heard of Flux before?
Yeah, I have Flux. It's good.
So for me, I put Flux on my computer and within 7 days I was sleeping better. I think the learning I had from that is I was staring at my computer too late at night for too long, but it was really sort of quite amazing to me that I didn't do anything other than install this app on my computer, which adjusts the brightness of your screen depending on the time of day and where you are in the world, and sleep better. And so that was sort of my first experience that got me thinking about the power of light sort of beyond what is clearly obvious, right? Like you see, you can see and you can do things. And, you know, maybe if you're watching a movie or something like that, it can sort of set a different tone for your environment. And I had a little bit of free time. I just sort of had sold Stitcher to Deezer, the French music company. And I decided to take time off. I had done that for about 8 years and it was time to sort of cool my jets and recover a little bit. And I started just reading. I just, you know, went to all the sort of scholarly articles, places that you can find on the internet, and just kept searching for, you know, why does light affect the way I sleep? And what I learned, I think, is, you know, two really sort of important things. One is that the scientific community has established this link for probably 15 to 20 years now. It's only sort of more recently come into mainstream sort of awareness, but the scientific community has documented how light affects our body and in particular our circadian rhythm for many years now. And the second is that the way that light operates and affects our bodies seems pretty common sense once you understand how it works. And that is, you know, if you believe in evolution, the human body is a product of about 3.5 billion years of cellular evolution on the planet Earth, all of which time the Earth was orbiting the sun in cyclical periods of light and dark. And so our bodies, our cells have evolved, they're hardwired to use that cycle for really important functions in homeostasis and health. And only in the last 100 years have we introduced artificial light as a external stimulant into our lives. And so sort of effectively, if you have lights that are bright, you know, in your spaces, you're telling your body that the sun is still in the middle of the sky and your body's going to react in the way that it's been evolutionarily programmed to do that. And so, you know, most people at night who aren't aware of lighting spend a lot of time with their lights on, and that's basically stimulating their body to stay awake. So once I had sort of like an experience and then some knowledge, I sort of said, hey, like that makes a ton of sense. I wanted to build Flux for my house as a hobby. right? I just was like, hey, I'm going to go get a bunch of smart bulbs. I'm going to get a tiny server. I'm going to write some code on the box and put it in my closet. And, you know, my lights are going to rise and fall with the sun in sort of seamless ways inside of my home. That was a total fail, a complete fail. I couldn't do that with anything that was available at the time in sort of 2014, primarily because a lot of the technology from a hardware perspective just wasn't there. Smart bulbs are sort of fundamentally flawed from a lighting perspective in the sense that they become dumb as soon as you turn the light switch off. There's no more power. And I have to sort of use an app all the time on my phone to control my lights, which seems like a step backwards relative to just a regular light switch. And that was really how I got interested in lighting. And then I realized sort of along the way that it seemed to me and, you know, eventually some of the early team members that we were approaching a time when these kludgy or sort of like, you know, hacked together experiences around lighting were going to be able to go away. And that was really sort of when we started. I mean, literally we went to Radio Shack and bought a bunch of Arduinos and started, you know, writing code on them to control lights and figure out what, first of all, what it meant to be a light switch, which is actually a lot more complicated than one would think. And then two, sort of what it means to sort of try to tie an automated system that controls a really important function inside of your life at home to your activity. And that was the early 2015s when we got started.
Wow. So what does it mean to be a light switch exactly?
Well, what it means to be a light switch, we can talk about the peer requirements. One is that you have to be very reliable, right? You know, if you come home and your power's out or your lights don't work, it's extremely difficult to occupy that space for very long. Mm. So you have to just be incredibly reliable as a product, right? You know, you can't sort of restart your app, if you will, and have a good experience. Two is that there's actually a lot of different types of light bulbs out there. The power that's in your wall powering your lights is not as consistent as you might think it is, right? There's fluctuations in that. And as a light switch, you sort of have to be the thing that regulates all of that and provides, you know, power to the light bulbs or light sources in a room in a way that is consistent and reliable. And so that's, you know, quite complicated. We ended up with Oro with a light switch that works with any light bulb, and that is not an insignificant amount of work.
Cool. So how did you then go about building it into a business?
Yeah, so I sort of convinced a former coworker of mine, and then I found and convinced another engineer on the hardware side to sort of say, like, let's just see what we can do here. Like, is it possible to build a system where you can sort of give up thinking about your lights, right? I mean, we've automated our doors, we've automated our toilets, like we've automated all these things in our life. Like, seems like lighting is a clear thing that, you know, there's no inherent value in walking over to a light switch and adjusting it. Nobody takes pleasure in that, but the light itself is extremely important. You know, can we get this to a level where, you know, your presence or activity or occupancy of a space is really what drives your environment as it relates to lighting? And we knew that if we were going to be right about this, there was a pretty interesting opportunity, right? So I think that was sort of the first thing that we wanted to make sure of. You know, is this something beyond a hobby, which for us might have been okay, or is this a business? And we sort of started looking around, and actually light switches are the sort of most sold by unit, you know, consumer electronics product in the world. Wow. 2.6 billion light switches are sold every year in the world. That's about twice as many as smartphones. That's because they're essentially a utility today. Mm. You know, if your light switch were to fail in that room where you're sitting right now, you probably within 24 to 48 hours would go replace it, right? Like, it's sort of this essential component. And, you know, of course, artificial light provides an immense amount of productive values for our lives, even though it carries some disruptive, you know, aspects to it. So we really kind of need it in many ways, or I guess not need it, we rely on it. And so, you know, we sort of looked at that and we saw that, you know, really all the companies that were out there, you know, every region has a different, you know, one or two major incumbents, right? You know, in the United States, it's Lutron. I think in sort of the UK and sort of Europe places, Europe area, you know, Schneider Electric, probably you've heard of, right? There are these big conglomerates that are essentially widget makers that have treated it like a utility. And so that I thought was our opportunity, was we can provide a better experience on this thing that has an incredibly sort of rich experiential edge. You know, how the light appears, like works in your home matters a lot to how you feel at home. in a way that none of these companies would be capable of doing. And so we thought that there was an opportunity somewhere. Obviously, we had sort of previous examples like Nest or other companies like that sort of reimagined a common household utility. And so we had at least some encouragement. And that was when we said, all right, let's make a go of this and see what we can do. So, you know, the first stage of getting a company off the ground, I think, is really less about the idea, right? I think ideas are I wouldn't say ideas are cheap, but there's lots of good ideas, right? If you're going to build a company that is going to require outside investment and you're not going to be able to bootstrap it all the way, you really need to sort of demonstrate a match between your idea and your team. And that, you know, this team is a team that has the possibility of realizing this idea, and this is a right match there. And for us, like, we actually weren't a match if you looked at us from the outside, right? You know, I had done computer software and product. You know, I'd ran a business before, but I had never done a hardware business. We had at least one hardware engineer, so we had some credibility there on the hardware side. But, you know, that was like one out of three of us. And, you know, we realized that we needed to demonstrate some capacity to sort of realize this idea. And so for the next year, we just bootstrapped it, right? You know, paid out of my own pocket, you know, for everybody's time and all the things that we had to buy, you know, hardware equipment, all those other things. And sort of our goal there was like, let's get to a version of a prototype that gives you a sense of this feeling of what it would be like to walk around your home and have your lights respond to you. And, you know, primarily just demonstrated the capacity of the team to actually build a piece of hardware like what was going to be required for Oro. And so that was really most of our first year, was trying and failing at all kinds of different ways of building the system to get to something where, you know, you could walk in the room and the lights turned on, you know, basically as soon as you arrived.
Yeah, that's neat. So from when you hit your targets, you then were able to raise investment?
We did. Sort of after we built this thing on a breadboard. It was literally a kitchen breadboard that we had like bought from the hardware store, and it had a bunch of like circuit boards and plastic on it, and wired over to a light bulb. And you could set that in a room, and if you had an app on your phone, you could walk around your house and it would turn on as soon as you entered the room. And that was sort of our proof point of like, hey, we're not complete jokers here, right? Like, if we knew what we wanted to do specifically, we could probably do it. And I think we went out, this was sort of in sort of the middle of 2015, and, you know, raising money. I mean, have you raised money before?
No, I've done like sort of fundraising from like schemes and things, but not investors as such.
It's just basically a brutal process, right? Yeah. Like, you know, if you're a masochist, I guess, which in some ways I are, like you find it somewhat fun, right? But it's like, you know, you're constantly just, you know, you've been living and breathing this thing, and you understand all the steps between where you are now and where you need to do to get to the next stage. And you get sort of, you know, an introduction, and then you get an hour to try to convince someone or really teach someone. That's really sort of early on, like what it was about was, you know, people have walked around their homes their entire lives saying, hey, this is just a light switch. It's something I don't care about. You know, you got to get them to reimagine two things. One was like, imagine never having to touch that thing ever again. And then two, imagine that if that becomes a portal to everything that's in your connected life. And that means that you have to become a really good storyteller, right? You know, early on, you're sort of got like, I had a prototype and I had a deck that was ugly, and, you know, trying to figure out sort of how to communicate this sort of vision of a home that is a self-aware and interactive in every room of your house with a simple replacement for a light switch was not as tight as I'm explaining it now back then. And so you just get you get a lot of people that don't understand, and you just got to keep going. And then ultimately I had a meeting with Jerry Yang, the former CEO of Yahoo. And for better or worse, he was formerly like an electrical engineer. I think he might have a PhD in electrical engineering. So he super got into like, what was this hacked machine thing that we had built on this breadboard and like what was going on with it. I think Jerry was interested to sort of see what we could do. And he gave us, you know, for a startup in the hardware space, a decent sized check, but, you know, was it millions and millions of dollars? And he said, you know, he's like, build the first actual light switch. And like, let's see what that's about. And that was when we were able to get, you know, a bigger team. We went from 3 people to 6 people. And over the next year, we built this ugly light switch that wasn't even really like, it didn't even fit in the wall, right? Like Oro is a seamless replacement. It goes actually, you know, take out your existing light switch and it goes in the exact same spot. And we had this block that was probably using sort of the Imperial. It was like 2 inches wide by like 6 inches tall that like mounted on your where your light switch was and had a bunch of ugly sort of sensors on the front of it. And then we put those in people's homes and we said, hey, like, A, we know this is not going to burn your home down. B, like, it works, it's reliable, and we know it's not pretty looking, but tell us what you think about this when you just have your lights, you know, completely sort of off your mind. And that was really what got us, you know, I think both sort of internal and external confidence, like this was something that people would like and that it felt like it was the right time for, right? You know, timing is a big part of all kinds of companies. If you're too early, you're in trouble. If you're too late, you're in trouble. And so we had these things probably like, where were they? We're in like probably 10 different people's homes. And, you know, people were saying like, look, like, you know, every day I come home and this thing knows when I come home and I walk into the kitchen, whether my hands are empty or whether I have my hands filled with the baby or the groceries, the lights are on. And I love that. And that was really where we started sort of saying like, this is something that is ready to kind of take to the next level. We had sort of worked out all the individual pieces, and then we needed to sort of bring that to a product that we can ship to everybody.
Cool. And so at that point, you then kind of scaled up then from like 2016, 2017 onwards?
Yeah, so we took investment from Menlo Ventures and also from Amazon. And from there, we started growing. And, you know, that phase of building a business is sort of the hardest one because like, as soon as you take real money, I mean, every phase is really hard, right? But as soon as you take venture money, like the clock starts going, right? Like your bank account is now a lot bigger than it's ever been, but so are the expectations. And every day is a time that is getting shorter and shorter. And so, you know, we had to go about, you know, we're now 27 people. And I think in 2017, we went from 6 to 20 in a year. And so getting and finding those people and finding the right people to sort of help us along the way and become part of the team is just a CEO is just sort of like, you know, all the things in your world that you aren't going exactly how you like them to be going. And you have to become comfortable in the uncomfort zone. And so, you know, finding, and you know, I can't tell you how many times I was like, you know, 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning, having a cup of coffee with someone that I, you know, had been chasing on email for, you know, 3 weeks to get a cup of coffee, trying to convince them that, you know, look, you should leave your nice cushy job and you should come work at this, you know, small company that's building this thing that is going to be awesome, but we're all going to have to work really hard to do that. And, you know, we have to take some risk along the way to get there, which is, I think, an important part of getting from here and there is you got to find the right people along the way that are going to become your company. You know, not, it's no longer something that I had an idea about 3.5 years ago. It's actually the product of 25 other people's ownership.
Oh, cool. So what would you say were the best things that you could say to people to convince them to like give up their current job and take the risk?
I think that, I mean, fortunately, in the Bay Area, we have a community where risk is really embraced, if you will, right? There, that's sort of one of the very appreciated components of this, right? I mean, it's extremely competitive, right? In the sense that there's hundreds of companies here that are doing really interesting things. And often a lot of them have money and they, you know, people have choices on where they want to work and what they want to work on. But at the same time, you know, so the first thing is you try to find an alignment around what the product and the company is trying to do. Because if you don't care about that, then you're not going to care about what the company, you know, you're not going to leave a nice, comfortable place to do that. And so I think we benefited because I think everybody has light switches in their homes and everybody is someone, you know, who can easily relate to you know, thinking about what if this experience was better, right? And what, you know, what would that look like? You know, sort of in a way that's different. And then if I show up on your door and say, hey, we're going to build the best algorithm for optimizing ads ever, it's a much further away sort of goal or, you know, aim, and it's sort of less personal. So I think I was really benefited by the fact that, you know, you could sort of say, look, like your home is, every moment of it is touched by light, and we're going to make that perfect at every moment without you having to do anything. And then after we do that, there's this incredibly powerful and capable device in every room, and we're going to be able to update that with software, and it's just going to get new superpowers. And that was really helpful. The other side of the equation is now, like, what's my risk tolerance, right? And I think one of the things that I learned quickly is that, you know, once we had alignment, like, you have to ask those questions of, like, figure out where a person is in their sort of spectrum of risk tolerance. Because it's, the sooner you identify that they're not tolerant of risk, the sooner you're just like, look, amazing to meet you. We'd love to stay connected, but this doesn't probably feel like it's the right time for you. Like, you know, let's not waste either of our times, you know, continuing to talk about this. Like, let me know if you ever change your sort of thinking on this, right? Now, to sort of go back to where I started, in sort of this ecosystem, unless you lie or do something incredibly stupid, like, everything that's an experience is, like, really powerful in sort of adding to what you know and can contribute to a team, right? And because the job market is as competitive as it is, you know, companies die, and the people that were working at those companies have jobs within like 2 weeks, right? Because the experience is very valuable. And, you know, the mentality of a person who's willing to go to an early company is sort of different than you might find at a Fortune 500 company. And those are skill sets and mentality that are valued by, you know, the companies that are local around here and more everywhere in the world. So I think that became my tool, which is like, look, this thing fails, you spend a year doing it, and then you have like a job in a week after that's gone. And like, all this is going to look like is a thing that you did that showed that you are willing to sort of take a leap, you know, and sort of you try to just back the risk out of the equation for them. You know, that doesn't work for everybody, but I think it's important for everybody at some time in their career to do something in sort of startup, because it's just an entirely different environment than being at a large company. Just the same way I would say, you know, everybody should spend some time at a large company and understand how those, you know, big things work before, you know, I think it's the other side of the world.
So when you were talking with people back then, as in, it's hard for me to really gauge because I'm kind of interviewing you, but I found that you can kind of start talking and you just keep going. So did you ever have that as a problem if you're like talking to potential employees, but actually you kind of met them for an hour and like actually you've just spoken for an hour and they've said like two things?
So I know that I can talk a lot, so that is something that I would be very careful of. And actually, in most cases, I think when you're interviewing and trying to recruit someone, you're spending a lot of time listening. First of all, you don't know whether you should say anything to that person at all, because like you don't want to just convince anyone to join your company. And so I would try to spend a lot of time listening, and then inevitably the conversations would end with me doing like, you know, a nice long sort of like, all right, like, what the hell is Oro and why is it interesting to you? I think, you know, in general, people find many things interesting. At least that's my experience. It's not so often that you find something that one person, you know, a person cares only about one thing. And so the more I listened up front, the more I could find the things that were going to be resonant with that person that I was talking to and make sure that I highlighted those in the ways that we could, right? If it's, you know, hey, I want to work on new types of hardware, or hey, I want to work with Android, or hey, I want to figure out whether Colin, you're an asshole or not, because I had an asshole boss before and I don't want to work with him, you know, and then be able to, like, I guess it's sales 101. People would probably tell me, I've never been a trained salesperson, so I couldn't tell you, but, you know, listen first and then talk.
So how do you concentrate on not being an asshole as a boss?
Well, it helps because I don't think I'm an asshole from the beginning. You know, if anything, I should try to be a little bit more
asshole-y.
I think everybody has a different leadership style. I think that for me, well, I would never like it if someone asked me to do something that they wouldn't be willing to do themselves. right? Mm. And not everybody can do the same thing, right? Like I can't sit down and write, you know, a bunch of Python, you know, to Redshift and get all the information, you know, get everything out of it. I mean, I wish I could learn. I think that'd be interesting, but I can't do it actually. But if I could do it, I would do it, right? And so for me, I've always tried to lead by example, right? You know, always have the highest work rate I could possibly put out for myself, you know, at a given time so that, you know, there's really sort of no question. You know, for the first 2 years of our company, I didn't pay myself a salary at all, right? And for me, it was just like, look, like I understand that everybody here is working for something less than they might get if they went to a big company. I want to show you that I think that that's valuable, and it's so valuable that I'm not even taking a salary. The other side of that is just trying to, you know, be reasonable with people. I think if anything, like the thing that I've had to develop as a CEO over the last couple of years is actually how to get not firm with people, but sort of, you know, I think a lot of with folks, like it's about, you know, making a promise to one another, right? Creating a commitment between you and I that we're going to do something, right? If I go to you and I say, Sam, I need you to do this, like you've given me no commitment, right? Like, yeah. You know, you have heard that I said, do this for me, but you didn't have any participation in that at all, right? And so for me, as a person who's not inherently an asshole, the lever or the aspect that I should work on is sort of like, let's make commitments to one another, right? You know, if you're able to help me out with this, then I'm able to do this to help you, right? And that sort of verbal and explicit commitment tends to have more accountability in the end than here's an arbitrary deadline and I need it done by then.
Yeah, cool. So definitely treating people more like people rather than just like cogs in the machine or something.
I don't think it's necessarily true, right? That you have to have a hostile work environment to like create, like some people would, right? I think some people you can talk to and they're like, look, like if it's not like people are pressed like all the way to the very edge, you're never going to get anything amazing out of them. I don't believe in that philosophy. I think that you probably get more productivity from your team, you know, when they're working on the project, they're, you know, they feel good, they're rested enough.
Yeah, definitely.
And your focus is towards something ambitious. You're not going to get 9 if you don't aim for 11. You'll never get 9 if you aim for 6.
Yeah, there's an interesting study where they kind of, I forgot which business it was, but they just cut off one whole day a week worth of work. And they found that people actually got all of their stuff done plus a bit more because they instead had a lot more reasons to say no to like excess meetings and like checking their email and doing stuff that wasn't useful work. And so they were just like, they had a much more like fixed mentality of just getting the stuff done that they needed to do. And so by actually having less work, they're more rested and just doing the work that was most important.
I think we've been benefited a lot, right, by sort of a lot of the psychology and behavioral economics stuff that people have talked a lot about, you know, in the last, I feel like it's been much more in the conversation in the last 5 to 7 years. And I think in general, a lot of that works, right? Or, you know, it works because it's more in reflection of how people think and operate than it is, you know, some hierarchical structure.
Definitely. That's interesting. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to hear a bit more about your experience with Stitcher then. So you were the founder? Because you said you sold it.
I wasn't the founder. I was one of the first 3 people to work on Stitcher. There were 2 people that were technically the founders before I was there.
Okay.
But, you know, I joined in 2007 and I was sort of the one that helped them sort of move from, well, where was podcasting before Stitcher and where was podcasting after is probably the more relevant, like this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in 2007, there was actually a lot of great podcast content. And, you know, we call podcasts sort of audio, sometimes video format today, but, you know, it was really sort of RSS distribution feeds back in 2007. And the way that you got that content was that you sort of took your white brick iPod and you plugged it into your computer and you had to sync all your content onto that computer, right? Or onto your iPod. Yeah. Which meant that you never had fresh content on your iPod because nobody syncs their iPods. You know, nobody did, right? Like how many, if you look at your iPhone, I probably haven't backed it up in 60 days, right? You just don't connect it, right? And so I was through, I don't forget exactly how, and again, sort of random set of connections got introduced to the founders and they were at the time doing this thing where they were taking all the sort of podcasts you had in iTunes, downloading the MP3s, and then stitching them, concatenating them together in a single MP3 file that you could sync to every day on your iPod. And then it would play as a continuous file on your iPod. Because if you didn't have that, you had to like listen to a podcast and then back out of the menu, you know, scroll the wheel, pick the next thing. Yeah. It was pretty terrible, but you know, you did it because it was a good place to get some content. Interesting people talking about interesting things. And they basically were just about to announce the iPhone, right? It was like, hey, this is like, there was the rumors. And I was like, hey, we just have to give up on this old thing and start going towards the new thing, which is going to probably be streaming. And it's going to be to something, whether it's a web page or something else that lives on these like much more capable devices that are clearly coming. And so we were some of the first people to really stream, you know, entertainment content on the internet. Like even before Spotify was streaming songs, we were streaming podcasts. It was kind of terrible in some ways because it was an edge network. And so like we had to do all this magic stuff to get it like stripped down so that you could stream it continuously over an edge network and all these other things. But our first, I think, big accomplishment was to get the world of podcasting into streaming. And so, you know, you didn't have to sync to your computer anymore. You could literally just go to a URL or a web page and stream your podcast to a mobile phone or your computer. And then after that was the discovery phase of the world where every sort of media company goes through, which is how do we get people to find more content that they love? But it was fun. It was that one was, we got to six people in like some crappy office on the side of a pier until we got a little bit bigger. But yeah, I guess being in random places and offices in the early days of a company is something that I tend to do more regularly than not.
Yeah, there are plenty enough, but it's nice when you look back at it.
Yeah.
For sure, it's cool.
Simpler times.
Yeah. How did you guys then, because I guess you really were just in the right place at the right time to then ride the huge wave of podcast expansion and stuff.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we're still in the midst of it, right? I actually think that this next wave of podcasting is probably going to be bigger than the previous one. And that, you know, is probably related to the sort of demographics of people that are starting to listen to podcasts now.
Yeah. It's getting much broader than just sort of young people. And
yeah. I mean, you don't really start listening to podcasts until you're like 24, 25 in most cases. Before that, music is the dominant thing that you're, you know, maybe now it's YouTube. But if you're turned 24 today, you've never even like really seen a radio. I mean, you have, but you never really used one, right? Like if you want content, you go online. If you want content that's, you know, like that you find in you know, interviews and conversations about things, you're going to end up listening to podcasts. And so the audience, I think, is just going to grow quite significantly in the next, you know, through the next generation. But at the time, we were in the right place at the right time with mobile, with the smartphone, right? You know, apps and streaming and all that came along and really helped us. And, you know, it was the early days of the app store where if you put like an asterisk in front of your app name, you ended up at the top of the list and stuff like that. Like, you know, you like did all those things to like sort of game the early days before, you know, Apple got smart and then Android came along. The other thing that really sort of, you know, if you step back, the thing that sort of helped Stitcher the most was just the sort of broadening expansion of wireless connection, right? So at first it was like smartphone, like a full edge connection, which was still small. The next real big thing that happened for us was that we started getting integrated by the auto manufacturers into the cars. So like alongside XM radio and all those other sort of previous, you know, AM and FM, obviously, the dashboard started to get smarter. And so then you could have apps like Pandora or Stitcher or any of these other music services just on your car. You could, you know, sort of same thing, I guess, with Aura in some ways. You could go in your car, you could take your phone, you could plug it into the aux jack and play something off of that. But you are always sort of fighting the uphill battle of convenience for the user, which is, it's pretty damn easy to press one on my dashboard and play something, right? Like, it needs to be that easy. And so, you know, we got embedded in the dashboards and, you know, on so like all the speakers and stuff like that. And that was a fun journey. We ultimately ended up, you know, starting to do the advertising model and monetize the service. And then Deezer came along in 2007 or 2014 and picked us up. And then I said it was time to take a rest.
Yeah. Cool. So you just were able to walk away and get your shares sort of sold, or?
Yeah. So I'd been there for 7 years. So I was already all, you know, sort of most of my shares were already sort of vested and whatnot. And I needed a break. I had done podcasting for 7 years. I felt like I had done everything that I wanted to do in podcasting, short of like probably making a better environment and sort of set of tools for the creators, right? Like I think that, you know, things like what Anchor has done in recent time, right, it make it easier to create content, make it easier to distribute and grow your audience. Those, that would probably be the thing that I would do if I had stayed. And, you know, I, life has its ups and downs, and they're not always related to work, right? So, you know, I had an up in work life. I was, you know, sort of on the sort of downside of something in my personal life. And I was just like, hey, it's time for me to take a break and decide, you know, staying for 7 years in and of itself is longer than most people stay at any company. So it was good at, you know, 30 years old to say, what am I going to do next? You know, is this the thing that I want to do? Probably good to take a step back.
Cool. So you've been working on Oro for 5 years now. So do you think you've got like another 2 years left? Was it?
Well, I mean, I would say I've been working on Oro, I guess, from like really in earnest for 3.5 years.
Okay.
And actually, I think that with Oro, I have a lot longer legs. You know, one of the things that was a challenge for me at Stitcher, sort of on the product side and everything else, is that podcasting, really any media company, it sort of has like three users, right? So you have your listeners in the case of Stitcher, right? Or your viewers. Then you have your creators, right? Unless you're sort of doing the whole pipeline, you're sort of working with a community of people that are creating content that is what's interesting for your listeners. And then you have, you know, if you're an advertising supported model, which most people are, like we're still in an age where I would say 60%+ of the revenue, I mean, it used to be 95% of the revenue comes from advertising. Hopefully we get to maybe some more paid content and subscriptions over time. So what happens with that sort of three-sided product equation is that you end up making decisions that sort of aren't in the best interest of all people, right? So, you know, a listener doesn't want to be interrupted by ads, but an advertiser wants to know, you know, wants to be on certain shows. Like, so as a result, you sort of get to this local maximum of, like, I can't make any more positive decisions for everybody in the group. I have to like start making trade-offs as to what I'm doing. And that, you know, I would say for someone who is more of a purist around product and in terms of like, hey, it's just try to do the best thing for the user, gets a little frustrating, right? You know, in time.
Definitely.
And so I think with Oro, what we do around the product and with the company is all in service of our homes, right? We want to make your life at home easier, fill it with the perfect light, and make your life at home one that can be more about thriving and spending time with the people that you love rather than, you know, there's no ulterior motive at Oro, right? And so for that, I think that I can actually get a lot more energy over the long run from that because I just need to, you know, the more we find out about how we can help people, the more we can build the next thing. And that is a relationship that I think has a lot longer longevity to it than where I was with Stitcher.
Yeah, that's cool. All right. So what would you say was the biggest risk you've ever taken?
I wouldn't say it was the biggest risk, but it was probably the biggest leap of faith. Obviously, like marrying my wife, you know, saying I want to love you for the rest of my life. And, you know, this is the partner that I'm going to have. Like that has probably been the biggest choice I've made in my life to date. And then, you know, I think professionally, the biggest risk I took was starting Oro. You know, I had done enough in my career, I guess, to have a nice cushy job, you know, in land and sort of say, hey, like, you know, not ride into the sunset, but take a, you know, for the next turn of the carousel, be in a place that is going to, you know, be pretty stable. You know, I definitely had people that were there on the sort of like come do this sort of equation. And sort of the biggest risk I took was like, I mean, I had no money at that time from anybody, right? And like, I was basically, you know, all that I have personal, you know, savings, you know, it was uncertain, right? You know, it's very uncertain in the early days when you start something, right? And you can't say, I know this is going to work or not, right? Like you can believe that it's going to work, but you don't have certainty. That was probably the biggest sort of professional risk that I took, which was to sort of say like, look, I'm going to go back to the bottom of a sort of company maturity and sort of try to build something up again. And fortunately it's worked out thus far, but at the time it certainly, you know, wasn't clear that it had any life at that time.
Yeah, no, nice. I mean, it sounds like it's going well, but then you said it was the biggest risk, but let's say you'd got a year in and it was clearly going pants. Would it have been the end of the world if you'd packed it in and just gone on to do something else?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that that's, you know, why I would say, well, there are things that when you retrospectively look at them that don't feel like that big of a thing, right? And then there's the sort of decision in the moment.
Yeah, in the moment, you're like, oh God, my life's going to be over if this doesn't work out. I'm missing all these big opportunities right now by taking this thing.
And I think that that's because fear of the uncertain has a disproportionate impact on our decision-making, right? Like you actually have to like find ways to de-weight that sense of uncertainty, insecurity, and fear in your decision-making. Like, because your mind's not going to do it for you, right? Your mind is like wired to do that. And so, yeah, it was like, I had like all kinds of like pro con tables and weighted things. Like I was, you know, trying to do everything I could rationally do on the rational side of my mind to sort of say like, look, like all of these things like are going to work out this way and that way, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, you still have this sort of like unquantifiable uncertainty like quotient that just creates fear. And then that thing gets multiplied by the fear factor in decision-making. And so that I would say it felt like one of the biggest decisions I made in my life. And, you know, what I ultimately ended up saying to myself as I walked through and I talked to a lot of people was that, you know, if I have to wrap this up in a year, in 5 years, in, you know, 10 years, and it's a complete zero, am I going to have learned a lot along the way? And like, am I going to be able to recover? And the answer is, most likely, yes, right? You have friends, you know, what's the worst case scenario is you like get on an airplane and fly to like Costa Rica and stay on the beach and start a scooter business. Like not that bad of a like life, right? You know, it's not like you're taking your life into your hands. So, you know, you get over yourself in those moments, but it certainly feels like a big risk.
Okay. Then what's the kindest thing that someone has ever done for you?
I would say, I mean, there's been a lot. So maybe something that's recently really touched me was, I mean, my wife, she does all kinds of, like, she has been incredibly kind to me throughout the entire time of Oro.
You trying to make up for something? You, like, pissed your wife off recently? You
know? No, I think that, you know, for me, it may be different for other people, but for me, the endeavor of trying to start a company and building a company is a sort of like mono focus. And, you know, in some ways it's like you wake up and you're thinking about it, you go to sleep and it's on the last thing on your mind. And that I think is important, but it doesn't mean it's easy for people around you. And so I think my wife has been kind to me by, you know, being instrumental in getting me away from work and doing those other types of things and sort of saying like, you know, look, like, I've already planned this trip. We're going to get in the car and we're going to drive. We went up to Napa about 6 months ago and like, it was all taken care of for me. And it was just because she knew that I would never do it for myself, but that I needed it incredibly just to step away. Like, you know, I think it's true that when you walk away from a problem and you come back 2 days later, the problem looks different and you might have another path through, yeah. But it's sometimes really hard to step away from something that you're really working on hard. And my wife is kind enough to understand who I am and work with me. So that is a type of love that I have not experienced before. Most people just get frustrated and angry with me.
Yeah, you're very lucky to have that around. And it sounds like you appreciate it. So that's good. I'm very happy for you.
Thanks.
What would you say is your favorite book or like the most useful book you've read?
The most useful book I've read, what's his name? Drive by Nathaniel Pink. For a while, I was really just reading everything in the sort of behavioral psychology. I think probably trying to figure out why I do the things that I do and why the people around me do that. But I think Drive was one of the first ones that helped me understand the components of why motivation occurs in ourselves. And I think that's been incredibly useful for me understanding who I am and incredibly useful in trying to understand what drives other people. Because it's extremely different for all of us, right? You know, for example, at Aura, we ask our like team members to sort of, you know, what's important to them and like, why are you doing this, right? And not because you want to make Aura successful or not because you want to make an Aura, like the Aura like switch amazing, but like, why are you doing this? Like, how does this all fit into your personal mission statement? Because the more you understand about that, the more you can actually help, you know, do two things. One is make sure that they're feeling fulfilled, because, you know, the achievement of something you're driving for is what fulfillment comes from, right? Like, you're aiming to learn how to, you want to train for a marathon, right? It's like, not the training itself that's fulfilling. It's like actually saying, hey, I wanted to do a marathon and I did it. And so, you know, Drive, I think, is the number one book that I've read recently.
Okay, nice. Then can you tell me what is the first memory from childhood that springs to mind?
Well, when you ask me this, it's me riding. Do you remember those like big wheel, you know, the tricycles with one big wheel and two small ones?
I do.
We had a small house where I lived with my parents, and they had like a little deck on the back. And yeah, my first memory when you said that was me riding that off the edge of the deck into a cactus.
Ooh, that's painful.
So I think I was like three maybe. So I was tiny and I just tipped over and landed on a cactus. And I remember screaming until my dad just came over and just like picked me up on my shirt and pulled me off the cactus.
Cool, yeah. Fascinating. Thanks. Okay, then is there anything that I haven't asked that I should have asked you?
No, I think we talked a lot. Hopefully I didn't talk for too long.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Actually, one thing I was wondering is, do you have any top tips for someone wanting to be successful in like Silicon Valley or in startup in general?
Two things I try to tell anybody who ever asks me those questions is that for better or worse, your relationships and your networks matter. You know, the getting and spending time on relationships so that you can get an introduction to the person that you want to talk to for whatever reason is, I think, an important part about it. I mean, I think that's in general, not only in Silicon Valley, but it certainly matters here. And the reason why that's important in my mind is that, you know, everybody has a filter and you have to get past the filter. And an introduction is a key way to get, you know, something going through someone's inbox or across their phone flagged for more attention. So that would be one. And two is, if you want to be successful in Silicon Valley, build something first, raise money later. You got to prove as much of the equation as you can on as little money as you can. That is the far more likely way to lead to progress in your journey than it is the other way around of trying to raise money first.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah. Then finally, is there anything you want to ask me?
Yeah. Just why did you start doing these interviews?
Yeah, I guess curiosity, really. I was just really interested in talking to people, because I guess a lot of my friends always asked me how I was successful in things, and a lot of it was finding people doing what I was already doing and asking them. So it was sort of a way of just showcasing the conversations that I was already having, but it gave me more leverage to have better conversations and go like one step further and reach out to people that I wouldn't have been able to talk to and like expand my network, but also create useful content at the same time.
Yeah.
And it was just like really fun. And I wasn't very confident at speaking, or like I didn't like phone calling people, leaving answer phone messages and things like that. And so forcing myself to do a podcast where I had to like record intros and breakdowns and things was actually a bit of a personal challenge, and it was kind of fun to just actually grow myself in. And then, yeah, I just really enjoyed doing it. Really, I've just always been really curious about things. It's quite nice.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to be on, and you know, let me know if I can ever be helpful for you personally.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, and same here.
All right. Enjoy.
Yeah, you too. Tara.
If you enjoy the podcast, I'd love to have your support on Patreon. I'm always open to feedback and just love having a chat with people, so I will definitely respond to all your emails and conversation on the Patreon channel. And you'll also get exclusive access to certain parts of interviews and free copies of whatever other content I start producing, such as books and courses, etc. Because why not?
You've just listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating, as these go a really long way. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will. Or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show, or you just want to chat, then please reach out to me on Twitter @SamHarrisTweets or Instagram @SamJamSnaps. Show notes and other links to topics discussed in the episodes are available at the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Give yourself a big hug from me. If you're with a friend, give them a hug as well. And I hope you enjoy your next podcast.